So good evening for some of you once again, for some of you not. I was joking, I mean the Tibetans hold that when you, the bigger you are, the better karma. They always say I overdid it. So next life, 185 will do. Slightly smaller head, that's it, yeah. Anyway, lots of stuff that you can stick in here. It has advantages. Yeah. Well, we have an upcoming weekend on the topic of Mahamudra, but I think there will be people tomorrow that are not here this evening, and maybe vice versa. So I thought of introducing the topic of calm abiding with a little bit of detail, so we can do that as a distinct topic. So that we have like a relatively independent argument this evening and then can practice it tomorrow morning. That will guide it in such a way that it will make sense of those that are newly here, that are newly joining us tomorrow. Another thing that I thought of actually before I forget to say it, and that's important now that Miffy is running away.
I'm coming back.
Well, I just wanted to, because I thought, just before I came here, I actually thought at the one point I produced a little overview document on the topic of calm abiding that you don't have. And if you want it, you can ask Miffy for it and I will send you the document later on. If you, because it is a complex topic, I will not make it overly complicated, but to be able to look back at the document later is helpful to recollect what you heard. That's easier than without a document, and it contains much more information. It's a vast topic, but I will pick something out for your purpose. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So you can run away now. Another thing that I also want to highlight, and in respect to the document that you receive and any general meditation manual, it is. Now, a way to say this would be that manuals are written for everyone, and thereby they are also written for no one. So they are like reference works. They are valuable, but like all reference works, if you want to study or practice, you need someone to tell you how this works out. So they belong, and it is in a way for all true for all spiritual texts, they belong to what they call a hermeneutical community. They take for granted that these texts will be explained to you by someone. Yeah. And so especially when we dive into technical topics as calm abiding, this becomes increasingly important. I mean, an abstract argument about karma, well, that you could read. It's good to have an explanation, but you'll be fine without it in a way. But when it comes to calming the mind, for example, this is a very different ballgame. Then the words do not always mean what they seem to mean. An additional thing to highlight here that I found extremely valuable is that, of course, when you then seek connection, closeness to a teacher that tells you how to do that, you very quickly find that every teacher, of course, then starts to speak from his or her own personal experience. It cannot be otherwise. And so a qualified teacher will do that in such a way that it is related to your experience. It becomes a personal relationship. But then things start to sound often very different. Now, I've done practices that were not found in books. At least it seemed that way. They made a lot of sense to do that, and they're still highly valuable in my practice, but I would never have done that on the basis of the book alone. On the other hand, I've done things that I would not have dared to do on my own, and that were only possible when I was held and made safe by someone else. Yeah. There were points where I would have stopped on my own, like, this is not okay anymore. And then to have the validation of a teacher says, it is okay, I will make sure that you keep exploring. If you fall, I will pick you up. That is very important as well. Yeah. So when you want to practice deeper forms of meditation, let's seek closeness to someone. The third aspect is there is a lot of, I should say this, there's a lot of opportunities to develop something that you will not want to develop looking back at it. Our mind is an extremely habitual creature. So if you train it in something, I will mention one of them later on. For example, if you train in subtle laxity, you have a major problem. And it is so easy to fall into that hole. Because, I mean, Tsongkhapa talks endlessly about it, so he was aware of many people actually doing that and thinking that was calm abiding, but then getting completely stuck. So also for that reason, it's good to have guidance, so that you're prepared for the challenges that will come, so that you don't have to fall into them and then be picked out of them again, and or getting stuck in our own, for example, pride. And at one point, you don't want to talk to a teacher anymore because, according to you, you just have become someone special. One of these fantastic Western neuroses. Yeah. So that, I think that's a very good preliminary qualification of what we are going to talk about. These are very important topics, but it's also very important to keep our mind sane. Yeah. For those of you that were here yesterday, you might have noticed that there's something else for that reason that I value a lot, and that is groundedness. Some of the topics that we study and practice here are far out, but they can only be done when we have a really deep, robust, grounded sense of being. Yeah. And yeah, so that is the way I will approach this topic this evening as well, so that we develop in a wholesome way on which we can build interesting things. Yeah. Even sky castles need foundations that way. Yeah. A good way to think about Buddhist practice is a practice of learning to let go. It's more to it than that, but it's a very good initial perspective. Our mind actively adds all kinds of things to our perception that are simply not true. Some of them are mistaken, some of them are wholly non-existent. As I said to you earlier, when you start to analyze what you think you see, you very quickly become aware of it, that the fact that it is not even possible, not even plausible. And yet, things appear that way. And so that additive function of the mind is what we want to try to calm down, so that we get to see things simply as they always were. And so with our practice, we're not trying to add something to the world. And we're not gonna, create fantasies. It is, I think, a very important aspect of the teachings of Jetsongkhapa, that I found his view of awakening very grounded in the world. That's the whole Tsongkhapa's point. We're not seeking a pathway out of here to some magical realm. The magical realm is here. It's a perspective. And we don't want to go, I mean, how could we work for the welfare of all living beings when we go somewhere else? Here are the living beings that we try to take care of. It's here that are our mothers, and to whom we want to become mothers in return. So for me, these are very important aspects of practice. And so when you, and that is a bit of, that is a very helpful and at the same time a slightly artificial separation, but it is very traditional. You have to separate practices, you end up with practices of calm abiding and special insight. But these are, and it is important to keep in mind, these are mutually entailed practices. Yeah. In fact, in the oldest layers of the sutras that we have, the Buddha does not make that conceptual separation at all. Both terms, vipassana and shamatha, are entirely missing from the text. And so only later on, when people started to teach others, they made this distinction because it's helpful. But like all conceptuality, then, we separate things from each other. And that is not a helpful way to think about practice. Anyway, with all these caveats in place, you could say that calm abiding is about calming the symptoms, and insight meditation or vipassana is healing the disease. So this evening is about working with the symptoms, so that we get to live lives that are more to our satisfaction. That would be, I think, a good starting point. And I mean that in an actually very important way. I have trained both actually as a lay practitioner for 20 years and as a monastic now for 20 years. Almost exactly 40 years. Wow. Sounds nice that way. Next year I can't say that anymore because I'm one of the all of these numbers will be off. Yeah. So I have some idea of how both develop. And there are differences between the two. Let's put it this way. There is a difference in how you work when you are in a place dedicated to a certain type of activity, a study monastery or a meditation monastery, or when you are operating in the world. At the moment, as a practitioner, I'm obviously operating in the world. I do, you know, if we have time for it, I will share some of the way I do it. I keep a very monastic discipline. Discipline is an essential ingredient in my existence. That's the way I keep space and stillness in my life. At the same time, when you look at my schedule, yeah, every time I enter an airport, I feel home, and that says a lot. Yeah. And so I would like to explore with you, how do we do that when we're in the world? And then, you know, you need to be more flexible, more dynamic. Is it possible? Well, it depends. I think it is important to them to be realistic. I will argue that every measure of calm that you practice is helpful to you. If it is a little bit, then you find your life a lot better. If it is a bit more, you find your life a whole lot more better. If you manage to get it, life becomes quite different. But we have to work with what is possible, not the ideal. Because many, as I highlighted yesterday as well, many practitioners become very frustrated because we all have the ambition to become the ideal. Yeah. You know, we all want to be in a few years Milarepa, sitting in the cave, eating only nettles or drinking nettle tea. It's also fine. And then you will very quickly realize that there's a few elements missing in Milarepa's biography. What is the aim of that practice of calm abiding? Like yesterday, I would like to approach it not in terms of an achievement, because that is where we already go wrong. Yeah. If I say achievement, then I see lights going on in your heads. And let's keep them off. Yeah. Because it implies something that instigates unwholesome behavior of our mind that you would end up struggling with a lot, and I did a lot. And that's not necessary. In a way, it is liberating a natural aspect of the mind. It makes the mind more natural and more spontaneous. And that is confrontational to say it in that way, because what I just implied is that our minds are not natural and spontaneous at all. Everyone knows that when you sit on a cushion and you try to follow your breath, you figure out that you are trying to follow the breath in the middle of a whirlwind. Yeah. There is a storm happening in your head. And that storm comes with the illusion that you wanted it in the first place, until you want to calm it down and you find out that you did not will it into place in the first place. That's a weird sentence, but it works. Yeah. I always say the problem with distractions is always that they seem permanent, but they also seem personal. And when you sit down, you realize they're neither. They're neither permanent. They leave actually almost no trace apart from, well, creating a rather unpleasant perspective of the world. But they're definitely not personal. Thoughts happen rather than being made by us. So it's very confrontational. So our minds in reality, when you look deeply, and like as an adult person, because it takes quite a robustness of character to realize that all the stuff that I take so personal in my head is not mine after all. And that's quite a step to take and to let it go. I always say, like, if most of this nonsense in our head revolves around me, I am this, I did that for that reason, blah, 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 blah. I always joke that this is the most expensive phenomena that we have, the ego. If you would have spent as much time on work as on talking about you, you would have been rich. Because this is ongoing, day in, day out, from early in the morning till late at night, and if you're unlucky, all night long. It's all about you. Well, it's not about you at all, I will argue tomorrow and this weekend. It's a construct that hides us from us, who we really are. It's filling holes by digging holes. And intensely so. And that's not freedom. That's slavery. But to give up on that very expensive narrative is hard. Because your mind will think like, well, if you're old enough, in my case, I've worked on this for decades. Yeah, good on you. I don't think so. And I don't know what then. Because I've never experienced life without that story. So where do I go if I ditch it? What am I? Do I still exist? So we'll come back to that. But the first obvious point is that with a chaotic mind, we cannot, to take a step back, to give you a taste of where we're going to. I will argue that Buddhahood or Arahatship, for that matter, is the perfection of personhood. Buddhas and Arahats are persons. They can act out of choice. They have the freedom to do so. They have the insight to know what is right and what is wrong information to discern. But we, our minds, are just raging on and on and on. And so we want to liberate our agency. And to liberate our agency, we need stillness. Stillness in which we can learn to look, learn to know what is inside, learn to know what is outside, so that we provide our mind with the right information to act in the world. That is, by the way, why the awakened ones are called Aryas, because they have choice, and because their actions are rightly guided, they are also ethically pure. Anyway, I'm elaborating a bit now. So the aim, when I elaborate a little bit on that, on these two words, natural and spontaneous, then a more nuanced description of calm abiding will be a mind endowed with clarity, stability, and pliancy. First list. One of my favorite jokes. Christians love God, Buddhists love lists. Etymologies, definitions as well. Yeah, but you can see it's very helpful, because then I don't need the text to read what I'm talking about. You know, if you just memorize a list, then the rest will follow quite on its own. And so stability in this case, well, it's a complex term, but it means, I would say, to explore a bit two things. On the one hand, stability is to get a continuity, where moments of mind, according to your choice, are similar. Because in our case, our mind is chaotic. No, you have an exam tomorrow, you would love to prepare, but your mind is all over the show. So you have sort of little moments of study interspersed with Instagram and WhatsApp and Netflix and a phone call to your best friend and shopping list and so on and so forth. And so when you look at how much time the mind spends on the topic that you would like to focus on, you very quickly realize it's very little. Moreover, every time that the mind jumps and needs to come back, it takes quite a bit of time to come back because it needs to recapitulate what I was busy with. Yeah, because like when I'm reading a text and I all of a sudden talk to you and I want to go back, I need to figure out where I was. Like what was the context in which I was reading or thinking or analyzing. And so every time I come back, I lose time. And then I want to listen to Miffy again, and then I forgot what she was talking about. So I need to, and so on and so forth. So with every jump, we lose enormous amounts of time. That's so much that when you look throughout your day, I would say that almost the majority of your time is wasted. It just gets lost between one thing and another. That's what shows that a stable mind is very useful. A mind that can continue to focus on the same thing for a while without being impelled to do something else. But of course, on the other hand, and that is more of a felt sense that is equally very important, is that the stable mind is also a robust mind. The untrained mind feels very much like a butterfly. It's unstable. And it also has its psychological challenges. An unstable mind is easy to pull the rug away from underneath. So it's not a healthy mind either. But to practice long-term meditation, we need to develop something that is quite robust. In the Vajrayana tradition, this is a bit of stage higher, but it's informative to talk about the Vajra mind. It's an unbreakable mind, a mind that feels solid. No, things move, but your mind is up. You can look at something that feels sturdy. That's very important for your mental health, especially when you use calm abiding to develop other things. I like the famous renunciation, which is not easy for the mind. The beginning, very liberating but tricky. And so these are two different aspects of stability, but there's much more to explore. But it's sort of like a good continuity in a sense of robustness and definitely very important aspects of that stability to get. Stability is not enough. Stability in and of itself becomes disbalanced and leads often to dull states of mind. So it needs, like many things within us, it needs a companion. And that companion is clarity. But clarity refers to quite an innate aspect of the mind. The mind, of course, is representational. And when you think that you are seeing light from outside, even neurologically, that makes no sense. And by the time you see anything, it has cascaded through your retina, to your optical nerve, and your visual cortex, and blah, 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 and then you see light. So you don't, the brightness of the light that you're seeing has nothing to do with the light outside. That's not possible. It's the representational power of your mind that you are aware of. Yeah. And so when we talk about luminosity, for example, of mind, that's what we mean, is the capacity, the forcefulness with which the mind can represent things. But again, as our mind jumps all over the place, this clarity is not much there. Our mind is pretty dull. It sees actually very little, which is not so nice to begin with. And so that long stability where you can stay with a certain topic for hours at a time only really works when it is balanced by immense clarity. And the text describes it as it feels, and it is quite correct, it feels as though you could count the atoms in the wall. That type of intensity. So it is an intense representation, and we will see in a moment where that comes from. So we will say later that, well, there's something additional to this. Is that our minds are also pretty unwieldy. And you would want to do A, and then your mind as well has something like an attitude like, yeah, well, We'll see about that. What do you have to offer? And we often do that, isn't it? Like, you know, you think like, oh, I shall now do great studies, and you might think that. I say, okay, so if you do really great studies, then this evening we will watch Netflix. That's it. We often end up negotiating with our own mind. Like, it, you know, you want to, you come up with something, you think like a really good idea, and then you might end up something like, I don't know. Yeah. You know, convince me or pay me. Yeah. And of course, there's also an attitude that you would prefer not to have. It would be nice if, when you see that which is beneficial to you or beneficial to others, that your mind would just rise to the occasion. You would think like, wow, yeah, of course, yeah. That is what is called pliancy in English. And here, I often say with French, you can sell everything. In French, they call this souplesse. I'm very good at selling Dharma in French. One of my other favorite words, and really I like it, love it a lot. And it's, in English, it's not bad. It's a sense of wonder, which I think is very important. And yesterday, we talked about a beginner's mind. And wonder, I like. But in French, it's le merveille. I mean, when you say that, your mind is already like, okay, we shall do that now. Yeah. And so you see, vocabulary matters. That's actually deliberately used by me. And you have one of the things that we'll talk about in a moment is that it's very important to learn to talk to our mind in a way that matters to our mind. That is one of the things that text cannot do for you. Every text needs translation. You need to figure out what the text says, and then you need to figure out, like, well, this is okay, but how do I make my mind believe that? How do I make my mind feel it? How do I make my mind feel the pertinence of what I just read? Why does it matter to me? And that takes quite a bit of work. And I, in my own practice and my teaching activities, I'm always looking for new vocabulary, new ways of saying the same thing to keep it fresh, to find words that when you say them, the mind thinks, well, if you talk like this, I will do that. You know, we're building a relation with our mind and our body. That's what's important, to figure out what our mind and our body like to hear, because otherwise we'll always end up imposing. And that is the topic of the weekend. That is not possible. We don't have that type of agency at all. We exist dependently on our body and mind. So the only way forward is to negotiate, to talk, to hear each other. And for that, we need good language. So far, that makes a good start. Good. And we are in business. Yeah. So keep these in mind, clear mind. So one could also say inquisitive mind, or curious mind, or a mind pervaded by wonder, and so on and so forth. It doesn't matter how you look at it, but it's a wanting to see. Yeah. Stability is when the mind is, one way of looking at it is where the mind becomes self-fulfilled. As we will see, one of the reasons why the mind is constantly distracted is that it is habituated, like a drug addict, to look for things outside of itself. And so it's not self-sustaining. And one of the things that calm abiding grants you is a self-sustaining awareness, where that which you need comes from within and does not need to be sought outside. Yeah? Where we are, and we need to trade off practice with Netflix. But that's an external, how to say, gratification. But you can see that all the tension is already there. Because if you want to practice calm abiding, say, well, after the session, we're going to watch Die Hard 55, which is not being made because it's not going well with Bruce Willis, by the way. But you can imagine when you promise your mind that at the beginning of your session, what do you think you're thinking about during the session? Bruce Willis, and not your meditation object. And so, especially in this type of practices, it's not working at all. We have to work with the mind. So that which sustains the practice must come from within and cannot come from outside. That is, by the way, also an important aspect of calm abiding for a practitioner, especially for a monastic, is that it makes the mind independent of the world. We talked about that yesterday. And one of the problems that we have in the world is that most of our relationship are conditional. But as a practitioner in general, with a monastic with way too many vows in specific, that must be overcome. That conditionality on external needs, you cannot continue with, because then you cannot keep your vows. But in the end, you remain also limited in the service we can offer. And so that finding in what Lama Yeshe always called the inner nuclear reactor and turn it on is very important, and calm abiding is the first step to do so. 40 minutes to introduce the topic. What is wrong with my mind? So when we go all the way back, you see that the great Master Asanga. Great Master Asanga is a master from the 6th century, often named together with his brother, Vasubandhu. This would definitely be a couple I would love to have met, and maybe I did, and then I don't remember. Asanga gave one of the many descriptions that we, that our tradition is rich in how calm abiding unfolds. That you can actually practice. That does not feed your sense of achievement, but that will feed your interest in this evening to sit on your cushion and to let it unfold by itself. That is my aim. He talks in terms of, and I will send you the list tomorrow, this evening, whenever you want. But he talks in terms of, let's say, challenges, also called hindrances. So, let's say unskillful activities of the mind. And what kind of skillful that we come or heal these unskillful activities? Now, one thing that I want to reiterate from yesterday is that one of the ways that I've learned to talk with my own mind, and you see me very carefully doing that, is to avoid normative terminology. It's not heard in the same way by Tibetans and Indians and Sri Lankese when they read that text, but we do. And so I will change a few of the words as they are usually translated in Asanga, because we hear them differently from what they mean. So when we say hindrances or negative behavior, we think in terms of characteristics. And so there is like an intellectual understanding of this, but there's also felt sense. And often these two don't match. So we might have an intellectual understanding, well, negative behavior, and at the same time, there's a felt judgment of our mind. And that is really important to avoid. The mind does these things because it thinks it has purpose. The mind always has a reason for what it does. And so we should also, first of all, honor the reason why the mind is doing that. That is a way you have a conversation. Now, if you're into management and you have a colleague that, or someone working for you that is not functioning well, you don't start the conversation by pointing out his or her mistakes, because that is where the conversation ends. Because then the other person immediately becomes defensive, business finished. So if you want to have a serious conversation with someone that is experiencing problems, you first list what that person is doing well. You express appreciation. That is the way to open a conversation. And so when you sit on your cushion and you tell your mind, well, this is really negative behavior, and your mind thinks, Netflix. And the thing that our mind fears the most is our own judgment. It will try to run away from it. And that is. Now we get to a problematic term. So the first three challenges that Asanga lists are often translated as forms of laziness. Terrible term. I've been looking for alternatives, and my current favorite is unserviceability. The mind does not want to serve you. And the question is, why? Why does it resist you? Why is it that when you do A, the mind does B? And that's very important to figure out. Because the first antidote to combine the three, or that Asanga list, is often called faith. One of these other words, yeah, trust is a better one. It's okay. Nothing is really helpful. Conviction, yeah. You have to figure out what that means. And then the definition of that term doesn't often help much either. It's trust in the practice and its results. And you think like, yeah, okay, if you, you know, whatever, you know. So let's do it a bit differently. As I highlighted, the mind does what it does because it believes it matters to it. It's something that it sees, that it pursues. But often, how do we want to adjust behavior of our belief is by judging it, especially anyone that grew up after the 1960s, because some Americans came up with a good idea, I guess from Protestant background, and my mother was Protestant, so I am an expert in this topic, is that you had to judge yourself harshly, because if you didn't, your life would not get anywhere. Many of us have incorporated this very violent feedback, and we fear giving it up because we fear losing control when we behave in that way. You'll see this weekend that this is completely unrealistic to begin with. But you can imagine when someone else tries to do that to you, you don't respond well either. So why would you want to do that to yourself? Why do you believe, despite all the counter-evidence, that this would ever work? And so when you look at the forms of unserviceability or however, and find your own terminology, but if I move immediately to the third one, it is the unserviceability of the mind not feeling good enough. It's self-underestimation. I cannot. But I cannot is the price you pay from that judgment and from the I am story. You impose something on yourself that's entirely unrealistic. And so when you keep imposing something on the mind, of course that the mind tries to escape you. Because it's not fair and it is harmful to the mind. The mind feels unpleasant, so the mind will seek relief. Of course it does. Now, we all spend undoubtedly some time talking negative about ourselves. And in the end, you get so fed up with that narrative in your head that you just click on Netflix. I mean, anything, not to have to listen to this stuff anymore. So of course the mind is unserviceable when that is the approach. This cannot work. This cannot possibly work. There's something deeper underlying that we will uncover this weekend, but this is a good place to start. So we will come back to trust in a moment, but when what happens when the mind feels not good about itself, when it struggles with a narrative that this is not going to work, when it fails to live up to whatever expectation we have, is that we will seek entertainment, it will seek distraction. So it does two things. On the one hand, it starts to procrastinate. On the other hand, it will seek empowerment from all kinds of what it are, in fact, completely useless activities. Yeah. Why does it procrastinate? Because when we procrastinate, we can keep the dream alive that one day this will work. Often we prefer to endlessly move it forward, not to have to be confronted with our own self-judgment when it doesn't work. It's nice when I can believe that maybe tomorrow I will become the great meditator. Because I'm holding on, I'm clinging to that story. I might never start it. So it stays where it is. And of course, that's not the way to get there. There's different reasons for it. Another reason is that we have this strange belief that tomorrow morning we will wake up. Yeah, sort of, it's like a misinterpretation of our experiment. We've been waking up, at least I've been waking up for 56 years, and then the mind comes to the conclusion that it will do that tomorrow morning again. And this is not the right analysis of that situation. Yeah. In fact, the more often you wake up, the greater chance becomes that you will not wake up the next morning. And so by the time you've woken up for 80 years, the chances are quite large that tomorrow morning is not happening after all. So there's a lot of dynamic involved. I just highlight some of it so that you might explore it. But I think for many of us, this is a very important reason why our mind procrastinates. Because on the one hand, we'd love to be able to do these things. And we love it. We read these great biographies of the great masters in Thailand and India and Nepal and Tibet. And we think like, oh, I'd love to be like that. But the moment we engage, of course, this starts to fall apart. At one point, we'd rather have the fantasy than the disappointment. That makes sense. And then we fill up time with all kinds of sort of activities that you do in a doctor's room, isn't it? And when you're waiting for the dentist, you read all the magazines that you would never read on your own accord. In France, it's always the Paris Match. Yeah, I don't know why someone would pay anything for this. I don't know what you have here. In the UK, you have, what is that famous newspaper? Yeah. The Sun. Yeah, I opened it once and I thought, as a monastic, you should not open it at all, actually. I found out. And you should avoid, especially the middle page. Because you feel that everyone saw what you're looking at. Yeah. So between us, no sun. Yeah. And so it is one of the many ways of to look at that dynamic, like why is that happening? So rather than fighting that activity, it is important to explore why does it happen? So that you don't have to fight the mind or that activity. Because that doesn't work, it just leads to more of the same. That's why so many people that try to work with calm abiding go around in circles. And then at one point just give up, like, this is not happening. And calm abiding has become quite rare in the world for that reason. Yeah. And so that is not helpful. And so the question is, why does the mind do that? So when you answer that for yourself, when you just observe the dynamic, you don't, first of all, you don't have to fight it. That's already so relaxing. Like, oh, my mind is procrastinating. Cool. Let's listen to it. Why are you doing that? And then you start to have a conversation. And that conversation brings you to that antidote that Asanga suggests, trust. The Dharma is not something outside of ourselves. The Dharma is not hanging up there on a cloud in a divine realm that we have to live up to. The English or the American monk, actually, Ajahn Sumedho, always beautifully translates the word Dharma as it is like that and love it. Because that's just what it is. Not something fancy, not something transcendent, you know, it's not like. These are mind maps. I mean, you don't believe that, that Tara sits, has been sitting for countless eons, like, just to inspire you. That makes no sense. There she is. And that would be highly awkward, even for a Buddha. It is something surprisingly normal. In fact, we are living in fantasy land. Buddhas are living in reality. our world, as we talked about earlier, our world, when you start to explore it, is completely weird. It's weirder than the Lord of the Rings. It makes the Lord of the Rings look like close to like an advancement towards reality. Yeah. So that is what the Dharma means. So when we talk about trust as a first antidote of faith, or whatever you want to call it, it is figuring out what the Dharma says about you. So the practice of calm abiding means is a description of your needs. It benefits you in a certain way. It nourishes the mind in a certain way that causes the mind to behave in a fashion that is skillful. Skillful in the sense that it brings you and the mind what it really seeks. Yeah, but unless you know why the mind is resisting you, you cannot tell that story. So as we talked about yesterday, that's why practice always starts with just looking. Sitting and know there is resistance. There is a longing to engage in all kinds of destructive activities. There is this sense of I am not good enough, maybe I cannot. And just to hear it, to say it's okay. I will not tell you that it's bad to do. It's normal. Tell me why it is. Why do you think that we cannot? Why do you think that we should be distracted? Why was what need does it meet that you procrastinate? And then the Dharma provides you with better alternatives. So once you have discovered the needs, then the Dharma will tell you, well, there's a good way to do that because these three ways do not deliver what you seek. In fact, they provide nothing but more messy mind and more unhappiness. Yeah, so that first one is to establish an internal trust relationship, a relationship of trust between person, body, and mind on the basis of an understanding of the Dharma. And then you can start to have that discussion with the mind. Like if I seek agency, if I want to be empowered in the world, if I want to feel good enough, I need a still mind. Mind that is calm. That is my refuge, that I can rely upon, stable, that sees with intensity and clarity, that is used, and no matter what we want to do, if we want to start a company, become a university professor, or a caretaker for that matter, that these qualities would serve all of us. And that is simply what the practice of calm abiding says. What we need is stability, clarity, and pliancy. Souplesse. Make sure that you practice afterwards. Yeah. And so what that conversation does is, and you could say that third form of it, which I did it as I told you as the first one, had that we suffer from that story of I'm not good enough. And we will see this weekend more in depth why that is. We profoundly misunderstand what it means to be a person. And so inevitably we all struggle with this thing, otherwise the Buddha would not have mentioned it. In fact, it was not existing 2,000 years ago. But that engagement on the basis of the Dharma with your own mind shows you that the mind is actually, on the one hand, capable of doing this, and that by these practices, it will be empowered to do so. And you see, you will notice that the potential or the seeds of the different qualities are already within you. And stability is not something that you have to conjure up out of nothingness. We have little moments of it sometimes. And when you are taken by a sense of wonder, for example, it appears momentarily. And when you see something that amazes you, that clarity is also naturally there. It is not new. Or when you're really moved by something or really inspired for a moment, the mind is all too willing to engage in activities that otherwise it wouldn't. And so we already all have little experiences of these three beautiful ornaments of the mind. And so this looking will provide you with insights that you have them, and the Dharma will tell you how to nourish them, not how to control them, but what to give to the mind such that they flourish. And that again, that deepens your trust relationship, because now mind and body feel heard by you, and vice versa. And it's amazing what you can do with that relationship. If the person serves the body and mind, your body and mind will serve you in remarkable ways. What we try to develop is a mutual care relationship and not an imposition relationship. That the ego is the great dictator of the mind, and it does a bad job, as by the way, all dictators do. Yeah. And still we long for them. I don't know how we get to have it. Different story. And so when we see the capabilities of the mind, when we are enriched by the Buddha of how to nourish these capabilities, aspiration arises. Like, these are the characteristics that I would really like to nourish, because they are worth my while. And so it is a seeing of what is, rather than ambition, because ambition is always a denial of the present. Ambition always says, this present is not good enough. I struggled with this. In fact, the first job I ever had was just palliative care, and I loved it. I was good at it. But somewhere in the back of my head was this voice, yeah, but it's not good enough. And so then you climb the societal ladder, and the more I went up, the more lost I became, because I did not, I could do that. It was not what I wanted. It was not what I really was good at. It was not why, then you end up being a top manager, and then what? And you wake up in the morning and think, I need to tell all these people again what they need to do. And then in the commercial company in a way that they don't want to. So I should blackmail them by their salary. No, I shall go to bed. Yeah. That's not the way you want to work with yourself. And so aspiration is to figure out what the mind can and wants to do, and to provide it. And that leads to the third one. Again, it's one of these words that we really should chuck. It's often translated as joyous effort. The joyous part is okay. I agree. But the effort, I don't agree with. Yeah. A bit better is enthusiasm, by the way. Yeah. Often sometimes also translated as energy. Enthusiasm, if I would have a discussion with that translator, I would say that enthusiasm is actually the opposite of what we understand to be effort. Because when we think about effort, we think about enforcing something. Like, the mind doesn't want to do that. I shall make it. Yeah. And that doesn't work. In fact, that is why so many Western meditators, in Tibetan terms, develop what they call lung disease. It's a very nervous mind. And they try to force themselves into awakening, and the only thing that they end up with is a nervous problem. Don't do that. Relax. Learn to negotiate. Learn to talk. Learn to listen. That's between others and you, a healthy skill to have, but that's also on your cushion, a very healthy skill to have. Enthusiasm arises when the mind feels empowered, when the mind starts to think on its own accord, I can, and I love it. That's where you really want to go. I never think like, oh, I have to study another text again. And when I wake up, where's my Kindle? Now my mind wants to go there because it loves these things. I don't need to think like, oh, another one of these fantastic tantric words. I need to do my commitments. I mean, who invented that? I mean, the moment you say the word commitment, the mind is already like out of the door, like, bye-bye, you do your commitments, me, I'm distracted. I prefer my distractions over that sort of nonsense. That is not the way to go. Enthusiasm arises when your mind starts to love it, and you have to figure out how to do that. And it is especially happening when the mind feels empowered by the way you talk to it. It believes, it understands, it can be done. I can do that, and it's fantastic. And every step of the path is amazing. I don't need to achieve tomorrow. I can do that in my own time. As Gandhi so magnificently said, you can't push a stream. It flows by itself, but we can canalize it. We can make it go a little bit more to the left or to the right. And when you can sit like that, then you have started practicing. Then you sit on your cushion completely at ease, observe what it does, and you work with what is happening. So far? Okay, a little bit more. The end result of this, but that is the when calm abiding happens, is called pliancy. But you will see pliancy grow on the way. That is often presented as an achievement at the end. Let's not do that. It comes to fulfillment at one point, but you see it grow. And you bring that quality to adulthood, one could say, like a mother nourishes a child into the world. At one point, it is capable of doing its own thing. But you will see it grow and become powerful along the lines. So when you've established that, then two other aspects come into view. The last two are pretty easy. First of all, it's called mindfulness, and we talked about that yesterday. Now, mindfulness is its opposite, and the problem that we have is forgetfulness. And forgetfulness forgets what we were doing, forgetfulness, in fact, forgets our entire agency. And forgetfulness is that rabbit hole that you fall down into without any freedom whatsoever. Yeah, and then you end up at the bottom and you think like, how did I end up there? And you all notice how this works. And all of a sudden there's anger, and then 10 minutes later you look back at it like, I have a memory of something, but I'm not sure why this happened. Hell, you spend an hour scrolling on your Facebook, and then you come out of it sort of like out of like, it's like a daze. You think, how did this happen? How did this ever make sense? And so it's very easy to see the difference. In a forgetful mind lacks introspection. There's no self-awareness in there. It's like television. It's a simulation in which there's no freedom. It's purely conditioned by karma, nothing else. There's no freedom to be had there. It does only unwholesome things to your mind. But as we discussed at the beginning, it always makes you believe as though it is what you wanted. That's a terrible thing on it. It feels personal because it's inside your mind. It's not personal at all. So mindfulness or wakefulness or attentiveness is the opposite, is a mind that naturally feels open. It's like opening your windows, bringing in fresh air, there's perspectives, and there's a stillness in there that you can use to reflect, like, is this worth my while? Is this correct? Do I understand this well? It comes with also with a slowing of time. Now, in forgetfulness, time rages on. But the moment you become attentive, it calms. It calms the storm. And so that attentiveness, when it is present in the mind, because it is introspective, it has the power to protect you against distractions. But in our case, often attentiveness, mindfulness is quite weak. So it is not very good at doing so. But then and sometimes definitions are very helpful. There's one crucial word in the definition of mindfulness. That is a capacity to hold on to a certain object that has a function of preventing distractions. But what type of object does it hold on to? A familiar object. How do you become familiar? By simply looking. The longer you look, the more familiar you become. And so by simply looking again and again and again, you'll become more familiar with what you look at, but you also become more familiar with mindfulness itself. And so it grows quite on its own. The only thing that you need to do is to use it. And every time you use it, it becomes stronger. A good added tool to make it grow is called appreciation or gratitude. When it arises, to also have a sense like, wow, it's great. This looks fantastic. So when forgetfulness arises again, try not to judge. Just see it for what it is. Take away the illusion. It's enough. There's no freedom there. There's not willed into existence. Doesn't deliver anything, ever. Distraction never calms you. Torpor never makes you restful. They can't do that. Distraction may just make your mind more upset than it already was, and torpor makes your mind even more dull than you started with. Neither can do that. Yeah. Stability, in fact, and clarity do the trick. Yeah. Stability calms the mind, and clarity makes the mind very restful. Surprisingly. And so that term familiarity just means that what our practice is to keep sitting. And that is another aspect of that word trust, is to have a deep understanding. That is why we study a lot. Study is empowering, because you know the mechanics. And so you can trust the mechanics. No reason to push. No reason to watch like, am I already enlightened? You know it will happen on its own. You know how it unfolds. And so then you can do nothing but nourish the unfolding. That's it. So you can be completely relaxed on your cushion. The more relaxed you are, the more natural and spontaneous it unfolds. You just keep doing the same thing over and over and just enjoy the ride. And because, I mean, for Buddha's sake, how much can you complain when you can just sit on a cushion with a cup of nettle tea, not having to do much? What is that to complain about? Why on earth would you be distracted, want to be distracted from that? That's my half my life, just sitting, not doing much at all. Well, a little thought here and there, you know, maybe nice emotion, a little bit of love, a bit of compassion, just a little reflection on emptiness. And then just looking again, becoming familiar. That's all. And that is what that Buddha image behind me represents. But it represents ease in the world. Enlightened beings are at ease. We are not. We struggle with the world. We have friction with the world. We fight with the world. But the enlightened ones don't. They navigate the world. That is two more, and then you have heard all of it. The first one is called, as one of these other, some of these Buddhist authors need marketing managers. It's called application. Like one of these, like again, like when you walk in a supermarket and you see a box application, you just walk past. I mean, when you go to a library, there's a book called application. I mean, unless you were in IT, and only IT people are attracted by books that say application. Everyone else walks along, like, I don't think so. Yeah. Application, and that is actually an aspect of mindfulness itself. Application means that mindfulness is capable of, because it provides you with perspective, provides you with the capacity to know what is going on. It therefore also provides you with the tools to navigate what is going on. That is one of the things that mindfulness, as we saw yesterday, remembers. Application here simply means that use the knowledge. Be be empowered by using it. And especially again for Westerners, when we think of calm abiding, we think of relaxing. And when we think of relaxing, we think of something like slouching in a couch. Calm abiding is the opposite. It's like you did not know that you had a light like that in your mind. It's like a blinding searchlight. So you turn something on. And so it means that this is an invitation to actively engage in these different capacities of the mind. The mind is thinking a bit, to activate the mind's capacity to analyze, to know actively. When it's being distracted, the mind has a capacity to stabilize, to calm. So to actively engage with these different aspects of the mind and to be empowered by it. The next one, so far that makes sense, that's easy. The next one is interestingly the opposite. Equally interesting, equally attractively called non-aggregation. Yeah, that's the book that even IT people pass by. This means the other side of the coin of this term means familiarity, where the mind out of habit is still wanting to control, wanting to compensate, but where in fact this is no longer necessary. And here, this is where trust comes to fulfillment. But you need then to observe the mind can do this now. There's no reason to intervene. Introspection performs no further function. This is where this distracted activity of the mind and the torpidly sinking aspect of the mind are overcome. So I hitched two in together. So if you really want to be traditionally safe, then between after mindfulness, the antidote listed is actually introspection. But I combine them into two because they're always found together. Where there's mindfulness, there is introspection, and vice versa. Yeah. And so the mind often, as we've discussed, the mind often does too little or too much. That is what you will end up struggling with a bit. And introspection is then capable of noticing that this is the case and knowing how to balance this out. Now, there's an infinity of more things to say, but I think we have 11 minutes for questions.
So, Venerable, I've got to apologize because last night Janet, who was here, had a question, but we're running out of time. And so I was clearly grasping at permanence because she was going to be here tonight and over the weekend and everything slotted into volunteer. But then last night she got a phone call that her mother had died, so she's over to the nursing home with mother, and so I felt really bad about that. So I promised to ask her question, and the question was about: is it possible with the judging mind to be able to judge in a good way? Like last night when you talked about how we kind of judge people. So for instance, you see a stranger do a good deed and your mind says, oh, what a kind person, I must say a prayer for them. So in other words, I train my mind to see, but not to judge if it's going to be negative, but to judge that it's a kind person. Is that wrong, or how to do that?
Good question, and both are unhelpful. Because if you say that is a good person, you create a story for that person cannot live up to. And then that person will do a mistake, and then your mind comes up with the opposite conclusion. The person was lying after all. It's a bad person. And so the problem, the inherent problem of judgment is, as we will see this weekend, is the conceit of I am. the idea that we have inalterable, independent, unchanging characteristics by which we can be known. And this is not possible. And so all judgment takes a wrong view as its basis. And so whether this is a relatively positive evaluation or negative, they both end up with the same problem. Yeah. And that's the problem. This, the whole problem with the ego is that we cannot live up to it, or we cannot escape from it, because it is an immovable story. Because if you are like that, then the only way to change that is to get rid of you. And that is not a path to practice. Different shirt today. Slazinger. Whatever that is. Yeah, that's we rejoice in that.
So that my name is around you. When you were talking about procrastination and meditation, you were saying we put it off because we can live with the dream that we will one day be a great meditator, but we just we don't want to face reality that maybe we don't start. I have a problem sometimes when I actually have a degree of success in my meditation, it goes really well. I feel like, wow, why was I putting this off? Like, it was great that I did this. But it's not enough to get me back on the cushion the next day. what do you think that kind of obstacle would be?
Oh, I should tell you a funny story. Because the answer is that we approach what when it goes well in the wrong way. I led for 5 years something was called the Yogi Bootcamp, like an intensive training. So I guided people personally. And looking back at it, of that year, I would spend the first 3 months establishing a trust relationship. Because one of the, why do teachers play a major role in all Buddhist tradition, especially in this one, is that they help us get us out of our own way. So we end up on the trust relationship, on the base of that trust relationship, doing what the other person tells us, rather than ambition. And that, when that happens, so when that mutual trust relationship has come into existence, we just practice because, this is the instruction that we got. And then you get a very natural unfolding. And so around Christmas time, then I would on a regular basis have an interview where someone's calling them, having a conversation again, and you know, I had the most marvelous meditation. And I was like, yeah, I know exactly what conversation we are going to have next week. And that conversation next week was always, this was the most rotten meditation week ever, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. And it's almost inevitable. I tell all of them that in advance. Actually, I give them a booklet that says that this is the case. And 99 out of the 100 still go for it, wholeheartedly. And why is this? Because it's just a mistake that we will look at this weekend. Something good happens. What do? We didn't, another one of these words, we appropriate it. We make it into a self-characteristic, into an I story. And that is not true. And so you have just in that moment created your moment of failure. And your mind is going to live up to that expectation. Because you are not that way. And when karma abiding arises, it's not something that you did, it's something that happens to you. You never know when it happens. And you sit for ages, like following your breath or observing whatever you have, and it's going nowhere, and all of a sudden in the meditation session, your mind thinks, we're going to approach this differently. And then you will always end up with that extra thing, this ignorance. I did it. And in that way, you didn't. And the real answer is always appreciation, gratitude. To tell the mind, wow, this was cool. Give it positive feedback. Use that relationality. Like, I didn't do that, but what you did was amazing. I don't know how you did it. But I'll be very grateful if you do that again. Because that the emotion of gratitude is always in a way selfless. It helps you by its very nature of that emotion to step away of that I am doing something discourse. because that's not exactly the way these things happen. So gratitude or appreciation is a very skillful mind state. And then, because, and that's maybe the one thing to add, is that the mind looks forward to the next moment of appreciation, as we all do.
So this one is from Karen last night. What keeps you going in your practice day to day, especially during difficult times?
I've learned to do it especially when I have difficult times. For those on Zoom, there's, in my mind, there is no indication whatsoever to look at the camera. I mean, I have all these interesting faces in front of me and a black, shiny thing. So, yeah. There's no characteristic here that pulls my attention.
Well, Karen did just send love heart. So if you look down there, there will be a reward.
But yeah, I did not even answer the question, I think. Did I?
A picky answer.
Well, I would say that, so on the one hand, and that's one of these other things that you discover, that difficult moments are actually even have greater liberative potential than moments that we experience as pleasant. And you cannot overcome a hindrance that you're not experiencing. You have to see what the mind is doing and why it does that. And that is greatly alleviating to challenging states of mind. To give you a story so that you remember them. Can I go a bit over time? See, free will is completely overrated. I told you, I think yesterday, the story of Lawrence of Arabia. Did I not? I tell it on a regular basis. Some of these cues are very helpful. Anyway, just to make it as short as possible, there's this weird film that's really colonial and should not watch, actually. But in it is Peter O'Toole playing Lawrence of Arabia at the early stages of his career. And he's like in sort of a map room playing with other officers, and they're doing some special magic trick. He takes a match, lights it, and extinguishes it with his fingers. And then some other officer tries that as well, and of course burns his fingers and says something along the lines of, "This hurts, how do you do that?" And he says something very important. He says, "The trick is not to mind that it hurts." The Buddha emphasizes we will have suffering and dissatisfaction for a while, but our not wanting it is by far worse. The second thing is where we have choice. We don't have to mind it. So when there is sadness, or when there is depression, or when there's anger, and I talk from personal experience, it was a fantastic discovery that these things did not have to go away, that I don't have to mind it, because minding is, again, the judgment, it should not be that way. But if my mind feels like that, it has a reason for it. And so the most powerful thing is to learn to sit also with your difficult moments, because then that is the moment that your mind especially needs it. And in that session, nothing needs to happen. In that session, the mind just needs to be seen. That's it. And I've sat entire sessions just with a completely chaotic mind that did not know what to do, that was absolutely lost. But the empowering thing was that I did not walk away from it. I just observed caringly, my mind does not know where to go. It's panicking. And it's fine. But at first, when we come back to our topic, I need trust. And the trust is then to say, I am unconditionally here for you. I will always turn up to the occasion. If you feel good or bad, in fact, I will turn up to the occasion more when you feel bad. And so my last job was a terrible job. I always say I was in hell. It was a marketing company. I was at the wrong place, and I got stuck in my own ethical sense. And I could neither leave nor get out, but I did not know how to manage that. I had no background in in cooperative work. I come from a nonprofit sector. And so I didn't know how to manage the situation. And I was lost. I was profoundly lost. And I just doubled down on my practice because that's the way I survived. I just got up earlier because I needed 2 hours of meditation to straighten out my mind in the morning. And I really needed 2 hours of meditation in the evening to be able to go back to sleep. And that develops a trust relationship that then facilitates calm abiding because you become safe in relationship to yourself. Yeah. And I've said a lot of sessions where the mind was not going anywhere. And that's fine. That's simply the way it is. And that's the other side of appreciation. So you gotta appreciate the mind when you care for the mind. These are the ways to navigate it. Make sense? Yeah. So one question, and I will actually give a short summary of what I said. Maybe Miffy, we could give the camera one of your jackets. That would do it.
We've been thinking about the mind doesn't do what we want it to do. Could you explain, please, the difference between the mind and yourself?
Ooh, tomorrow. That's a challenging topic. Okay. To give you a cliffhanger, the person exists, but it exists dependently. The person exists, but it exists only dependently. That is why the wish for absolute control fails, because absolute control or judgment implies a self or a person that exists independently of the mind, the puppet player. You might have noticed there's no such thing. But then we will have it all. So to give you the list again, hassle hindrances are respectively the unserviceability of procrastination, of attachment to unskillful actions, and of self-diminishment, one could say. The next one is forgetfulness. The next one is twofold, as one could say, over and underactivity, or distraction and laxity. The next one is non-application. And the final one is, interestingly enough, application. And so of the first three, the non-serviceability of the mind, the tools that the mind already possesses to navigate them, they are respectively trust, aspiration, enthusiasm, and pliancy. The antidote to forgetfulness is mindfulness. The antidote to laxity and excitement is an introspection, recognizing them as such and knowing what to do with them. The antidote to non-application is to use the tools that you have, to have trust that by using them, you will empower them. They grow on their own accord. And the final one, when familiarity arises, learn to calm the excess activity. There comes a moment in your practice when the mind no longer needs a navigator. It knows how to do this on its own accord. Meditation ultimately is profoundly selfless. In deep meditation, there is no meditator. There's an unfolding completely natural. And that is where that feels like real power. I would say that for me, that's the same thing as with teaching. The first time I ever taught in bad French with a limited understanding of the Dharma with a group that I've never met before, I felt uncomfortable. So we feel seen, we feel self-conscious, we start to contrive a story, and what happens? Well, not much at all. And they were happy enough that I tried to speak French, but for the rest, this is not working. That sort of control we don't have. What you really want, as I had this evening, is when this just happens. I sit here, I generate motivation, and the rest of the evening unfolds quite on its own accord because I gave my mind what it needs. They can just do that. No agent, no controller, no puppet player required. That is what freedom feels like. That is where enlightenment goes towards to. As the Buddha says, when we are free of the conceit of I am, where we are a perfect happening in the world. That's freedom. And calm abiding provides you with the first taste because it calms those processes that are artificial. Insight, as we will see this weekend, takes the source of this artificiality away by seeing that what we see when we say I doesn't exist most of the time. To figure out then what really exists, what we mean by that term.